Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 48. We're still in section 6. In the single column, old single column, we're on page 555. We're ready to start that last subsection. Subsection number 7 in section 6 about the ministering reserves. So remember what we're in the midst of, this lengthy section. If you flip back, you see it's what in the immediate context of this paper about the Maranatha life, they're speaking of as Maranatha world seraphim. The other designation is transition ministers. And when you think about that title, the transition is obviously not just some immediate transition, in the wake of you leaving your nativity sphere, but the whole transition from your nativity sphere and a material identity all the way until you leave the local universe. As a first stage spirit, so that whole transition is in play in the bigger context. See, it's Maranatha world, not just mansion world. Notice. So they're wanting these individuals to have that in their name, to have that more sweeping immediate implication. All right, but just like when we went through all of the other primary groups of seraphim. There's 7 different divisions of them or subgroups, whatever you want to call these different classification units. But we got to the final one, which was the way it always was. There's the 7th one, and it's always the reserves of that order. And again, here you see there's quite a bit of content. The author is not just going to give us the basic fact that there's reserves for this type of seraphim, but he's going to use this opportunity to give us a more very seminal content that we can reflect on in terms of how to begin to strike step with the cosmos in a more objective way, to challenge yourself, as these angels will help you to do, to leave behind your very subjective beginnings and to take on a much more integrous and all the more, ever more sweeping objective perspective. All right, so let's see what we got here.
7, ministering reserves. A large core of all orders of the transition seraphim is held on the first mansion world. Next to the destiny guardians, these transition ministers draw the nearest to humans of all orders of seraphim, and many of your leisure moments will be spent with them. Angels take delight in service, and when unassigned, often minister as volunteers. The soul of many an ascending mortal has for the first time been kindled by the divine fire of the will to serve, to service, through personal friendship with the volunteer servers of the seraphic reserves.
Okay, see, so you notice there's a large paragraph break after that. I mean, that's the basic statement that he wants to just make about this division. So even though they're giving it the Maranatha world designation, the reserves are on the first mansion world. So you have a combination of, that fact speaks to the fact that they're very much grounded at a foundational level in the cosmos, and that's picked up again when they say, aside from the destiny guardians, these transition ministers draw the nearest to humans. So, if you remember that, those primary orders of seraphim were in a hierarchy, you know, and they were coming down, you know, constellation level, local system level, planetary level. And then here, you can see this is really where the rubber meets the road, where they're more identified with the ascending mortals themselves than a world, you know, or a level in the hierarchy. So it's very much, you know, the fact that they are down at the bottom of the stack, as it were, is indicated by that they're the nearest humans. And so in terms of this volunteer engagement of you, you can see why they would point that out here, that they're going to be the most immediately intimate in these times when they'll just sit down and chew the fat with you for a while, just allow you to have some fellowship with a fellow creature in the universe of universes. Now, that last part, the soul of many an ascending mortal, and of course when they say it like that, remember, oh yeah, I'm a Marantia being now, and my soul is not my soul. My soul is my Marantia brain. It's, you know, so the soul is a much more immediate fact when we're actually thinking of ourselves as a with a Marantia identity. But the soul of many an ascending mortal has for the first time been kindled by the divine fire of the will to service. You know, we all know that there can be a lot of ignorance or a lot of vicissitudes to an initial life on your initial world. The key thing, besides that sort of immediate fact that this may be first-time stuff for someone to think about service, notice it's not just service. You know, it doesn't say the divine fire of service, just service, but will to service. To take service beyond something that you just do because that's what the Moray system dictates, you know, and you can do that as a fancy animal. You know, you can train animals to serve you. We do all the time. But to actually make it a personal phenomenon, to begin to make that personality fact that we've talked about a bit here recently, that's initially so abstract, much more tangible and much more in play. You're not just serving because that's what duty demands or whatever, but it's free service and liberty-loving devotion. You know, you're beginning to get into that genuine personal consecration to the phenomenon or the act of service.
Isn't service, was it the destiny of space and the goal of time, or the other way around? So throughout your entire career for forever on and on,
right?
It becomes more and more, it's really the basis of it all is about service.
Yeah, and because
it's the other side of things.
Well, I mean it's the connectivity aspect of things, you know, it's you connecting into the great web of reality in a very direct, intimate way. But you know, thinking about that fact that it's from now to eternity and endless cycles of eternity, there's service. If your service is just ritualistic, you know, if you're just going through the motions, you know, if they could replace your service with a service bot, you know, with a robot, that's going to run out of any significance after several trillion years, right? Let alone quintillions of years or whatever. So the fact that you have an absolute unique personality, you know, the more that comes into play, the more your service is absolutely unique. When you minister, no one else, not the Universal Father, not the Eternal Son, no one else can serve in that way. You know, so that obviously has to become, your personality manifestation has to become more and more definitive the more you go on towards eternity, so that it doesn't just become a routine phenomenon. It continues to be alive, forever, and an infinite potential of absolutely unique service. Okay.
I think when you, and just to go on just one more step, sorry. When you experience service, whether it be, as you say, in the beginning and the first times you do it down here, that it's just something that you do because you're told to do or whatever, it's more of a routine. Mm-hmm. But as you experience it, it takes a hold of you. It makes you feel good. Mm-hmm. It does things to you. So it's kind of like love. You know, it's one of those things you only get to keep that you give away. Mm-hmm. So service has that, it's got that drawing power to it that's kind of quite interesting.
Yeah. All right, so now let's see what they give us for some value-added content here in this context.
From them, you will learn to let pressure develop stability and certainty, to be faithful and earnest, and withal cheerful, to accept challenges without complaint, and to face difficulties and uncertainties without fear. They will ask, if you fail, will you rise indomitably to try anew? If you succeed, will you maintain a well-balanced poise, a stabilized and spiritualized attitude throughout every effort in the long struggle to break the fetters of material inertia, to attain the freedom of spirit existence?
Okay, so just look at that little nugget. Okay, so now, those initial statements, when you think about, being under pressure or trying to be very earnest, there's always this tendency for you to take yourself or to take the whole effort too seriously, right? Hence the, in spite of all that potential, you're going to be cheerful, right? That's the fact that they start out with that statement is a clue to where they're going in the rest of their little comment here. This issue of taking yourself too seriously is going to be a theme here, rather than cheerful. Okay, but pressure, let pressure develop stability and certainty. And your initial tendency is to try to get away from pressure, right? You see it as a negative. You don't see it as a potential positive if you have the maturity to use it. For an immature individual, it has no potential positive aspect. But to a mature individual, you can use pressure. Fundamentally, you need that pressure because you're not trying to develop a static stability. When they say stability and certainty here, you're trying to develop a dynamic stability. Something has to power a dynamic stability, right? You're going to be this stable flow because it's a universe of motion. Everything is dynamic, and you have to strike step with that. That pressure is going to power it. The tension that's being actualized out of the infinite reservoir of tension potential, the universal absolute, right? You're going to allow that potential to actualize within you, and it's going to power your dynamic nature. Okay, so that's another key element.
In other parts that too much pressure is not really good for you. So there's different two ways.
Too much pressure that is just that's stress. Not put into use, right? I mean, again, like I said, I mean, to an immature person, too much pressure will break you. That's what I was getting at. To accept challenges without complaint, to face difficulties and uncertainties without fear. Okay, now think about. Okay, we're talking about. Sitting down with an angel somewhere in my Marantia career, maybe it's on a dentia, right? And I'm having this wonderful conversation. And this angel is going to ask me, if you fail, will you rise indomitably to try anew? Okay. Is that a picture of heaven that humans have thought about? You know, a place where you go to fail and rise indomitably anew. Don't, you know, remember, I mean, there's a lot of positive here for thinking about it in this life, you know, what they're going to say here. But remember the immediacy. It's not this life they're talking about. Right? It's your whole Maranja career where you're going to have to face failure. Are you going to be mature enough to handle that failure? Or what about success? Are you going to be mature enough to handle success? That's all the more. That's the most dangerous. There's nothing more dangerous than success.
It's much more fun, though.
Because success will have a tendency to produce what? Pride, which goes before a fall. Right? See, that's what they're talking about here. A well-balanced poise, right? A stabilized and spiritualized attitude. And by spiritualized, like right now, right? Are you, you know, bringing in that integrity of your spiritualized mind in the upper domain of the hourglass as opposed to the unspiritualized mind in the lower domain? Okay. So that spiritualized attitude. And throughout every effort in the long struggle, again, doesn't sound like typical pictures of heaven, you know, just infinitely blissy places, you know, is what people usually have for their notions of heaven. Right? No, we're talking about failing and effort and struggle, and of course, conflict. Right? Yep.
All right. Just the other day, talking about after a dispensation and all the resurrected, all the sleeping survivors, all of a sudden come to life, and there they are on Mansion World Number One. Oh, a lot of them. And tons, billions. And because they've been sleeping a long time, they've had lots of deaths. I think a lot of them are going to be lost on the first and second Mansion World.
I mean, again, like we talked about, we went through the Mansion Worlds. That's the whole point, especially the first Mansion World and the second to a large degree, is to get you spun up, right? I mean, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to wake up with almost no connection to their previous life, right? You wake up lost like a little baby is lost when it's born, right? It can't even figure out what all these weird images are, you know, that are coming in through its sensory inputs, you know? You're going to have to get your bearings, and right. So you're going to need lots of help, but notice, you know, in the immediate context here, is they expect you to get your sea legs in short order, and you know these, for instance, these angels they're talking about here are going to be immediately challenging you to get in play and start failing and succeeding and maturing to handle that failure or that success, you know. So even the first Mansion World is not going to be, you know, kid glove world, okay? Right? I mean, you're going to be engaged vigorously. All right, and the whole bit of, you know, trying to break...
Don't look in the mirror right after you resurrect.
Trying to break the fetters of material inertia. I mean, think of it in just a very immediate, literal way. You have a Maranja body. Part of that energy, you know, is material energy, or physical energy. And you don't, you're on a first stage spirit until you leave the local universe. So, in various different ways, you are trying to break the fetters of material inertia all through the local universe, right? You're trying to pull yourself up out of that starting point and attain the freedom of spirit existence, first stage spirit and beyond. Okay, what else do they say?
Even as mortals, so have these angels been father to many disappointments. And they will point out that sometimes your most disappointing disappointments have become your greatest blessings. Sometimes the planting of a seed necessitates its death, the death of your fondest hopes, before it can be reborn to bear the fruits of new life and new opportunity. And from them you will learn to suffer less through sorrow and disappointment, first by making fewer personal plans concerning other personalities, and then by accepting your lot when you have faithfully performed your duty.
Okay. So it isn't all immediately relevant to the mansion worlds and the worlds above them, even as mortals. And you know, by there, they don't just mean prior to fusion. I mean, obviously, they're referring to material mortals here. You know, these angels have been the father of many disappointments. You know, this is the other big thing. You know, the more you read about angels in the Urantia book, the more you realize how off base human notions of angels have always been. Humans have always thought that it's the job of angels to make your life, you know, less difficult, you know, keep you from stubbing your toe and find a parking space for you when you can't find one, etc. Right? You know, and certainly make sure that you never get sick or something. No. No. I mean, their job is to make your life as rugged as you can handle. And so, you know, some of the greatest disappointments that humans have ever suffered are probably literally caused by the angels. They're not caused by happenstance, quote unquote, caused by happenstance. Right? They aren't just happenstance.
Without a push, we don't move at all.
Right. They all, you know, as soon as they're, an angel goes into service, they're issued a cattle prod, and out they go to minister to mankind. You know, and you say, well, that's a pretty crude analogy. Well, it's no different than the one they use in the book. What's the one they use in the book? These, they say the angels are the ones that wield the hammer, right, in the hammer and anvil analogy. Right, you know, if you had to pick between a cattle prod and your head on an anvil, okay, you probably would pick the cattle prod. So you got to. This is a. You can see that all of this is trying to challenge us away from bliss notions. You know that the whole point of existence is to achieve bliss. You know, it's the opposite. The whole point of existence is to not be so immature that you would want bliss. The point is to be mature. A mature person doesn't seek bliss. You know, that's an immature, ease-drifting soul that seeks bliss, you know, and turns it into a religious doctrine or something, you know, that's the purpose of existence. You know?
Well, a great many religionists feel that the sacrifice of bliss here is perfectly warranted because you're going to get it there. So everyone... Many, many people, the majority, I think, are waiting for the big bliss out in heaven.
Yeah, that's what I say. I mean, it's almost universal. You know, how much this is challenging our preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices.
2 months, I'd be bored to death.
Okay. All right. So, you know, and again, you know, okay, so I said, all right, I know this is a rough life. Okay, so maybe the angels are trying to help me by making it a little bit more rugged, building speed bumps. But certainly when I go to heaven, it's not going to be like that. No, right? I mean, you know, they don't just have one world to find opportunities for you. They've got a whole series of worlds where they can build speed bumps for you. And find ever more disappointing disappointments for you. But the more mature you are, the more they become your greatest blessings, right? I mean, those are potentials. You know, an immature child of God sees those as actualities of a negative nature. An adult of God sees those as potentialities of a positive nature. Okay, and what else do we have here? You got the whole bit about planting a seed. Yeah, that's, you know, or, you know, things like if you're going to make an omelet, you got to break some eggs, you know, various sayings we have like that. But then, you know, notice what they say, and from them, so all these difficulties, you will learn to suffer less through sorrow and disappointment. And see, that's something you have to learn. So in order to learn to suffer less, you have to have lots of sorrow and disappointment. You know, test number one. No, fail. Test number two. All right, so you're not going to escape sorrow and disappointment. Again, a lot of people think that heaven, you know, is salvation from sorrow and disappointment. And you're going, well, how much sorrow and disappointment could there be? Well, and something that we can immediately appreciate, we've talked about this when we went through the mansion worlds. What if you're on the first mansion world and your best friend ever is there? And your best friend ever chooses iniquity on the first mansion world. Think of the sorrow and disappointment you'll experience.
I never liked it.
You know, and can you be mature enough to deal with that objectively? And I said that up front here about the objective. All right, suffering, that's a subjective response. To just appreciate that. The extent to which you feel like you're constantly suffering through life, the extent to which you haven't taken a hold of the gifts of grace that you were given to be objective, just use that as a little litmus test. Remind yourself that you need to go up. You can go up. You don't have to suffer. You don't have to live on the level of the feelings. Right? You don't have to live on the second level of meaning. Right? You can go way up above that. You'll engage the same experiences, but you'll have more than just feelings in response to those experiences. If you've aggrandized the level of feelings to be the apex of reality, you know, if that's how you define religion and spiritual and everything, is just a level of feelings, right? You have no motivation to go up. And you know, and then you're wondering why you're constantly suffering. Well, you've aggrandized, you know, suffering. You know, you believe in sufferingism.
Victim.
Right?
Yep. Well, that's really what drives us up. But I was thinking, you know, when someone dies in this life and we grieve for them, we have hope. Well, there's heaven. Mm-hmm. You know. So that's a salve to our to our grief.
Mm-hmm.
They'll wake up in heaven and they have another chance. But if they choose iniquity, the salve for that isn't so readily.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was the point I was trying to make. I mean, you know, death is irrelevant. Actually, you know, physical death, that's really a nothing. Right? And the fact that we impose such, you know, suffering upon ourselves because of this, it's like, you know, what if you have to face real death? Right? Material death is not real. It has no relationship to eternity. Okay? Real death is iniquity. Okay? That has all relationship to eternity. Right? So anyway, just again, the challenge of not, you know, thinking about heaven with rose-colored glasses. Okay, now, one that you can definitely make a lot of use of here. One of the biggest problems we have is people making personal plans for other personalities. Right? Work, you know, if you work on anything in this life, work on that one. That's a very low-hanging fruit thing that you can immediately recognize that you're doing. Just catch yourself doing that. Oops, I'm making personal plans for another personality, like your spouse, say.
Is that what that means, versus personal plans?
Right, I mean, right.
Concerning other personalities means for them, versus personal plans about getting married and have kids and that kind of stuff. That's different, right?
Right. I mean, to think about the kind of abstractness of them saying personal plans and personalities, think destiny more, okay? Go beyond the immediate moment. Stop saying, well, you know, son, your destiny is this. You're going to be a doctor or whatever. Now, that doesn't mean that you just, you know, stay totally hands off and imagine that they somehow divinely self-actualize either. Right? But you know, be really careful about thinking that you can chart someone else's destiny. Remember, fundamentally, when you're talking about doing personal things, you're talking about things that are related to eternity, not time. Right? If it's just related to time, yourself can do that. But yourself has no relationship to eternity. Only your personality does. See, that's the fundamental distinction. You think about when you are really making plans that go beyond the moment and trying to say, you know, chart, you know, a career, a destiny, an eternity, you know, whatnot for someone else. You have no right, right? And you need to respect that absolutely unique relationship to eternity, right? You know, it's not going to overlap with yours. Yeah, there's the fundamental reason why you can't make plans, and so you shouldn't be thinking you should. You have no overlap with that other personality as a personality. Right? They're absolutely unique. You cannot see what they were designed to see. Respect that. And then by accepting your lot, when you have faithfully performed your duty. One of the things, your idealistic tension, when Jesus talks about why do the heathen rage. Now you got regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future. Now think about that second one. Yeah, whining over the present. See, accepting your lot when you have faithfully performed your duty. Right? Don't sit there and whine. Now, why don't I have as much money as that person does? Why don't I have a job like that person does? Right? Right? Don't get in that mode.
Kind of reminds me of the Alpheus twins who,
yeah?
After they did the service,
they accepted their lot. They didn't try to beat Peter. Right? And it's important because Peter can't do what they can do. That's why the Alpheus twins exist. There's jobs that they need to do. There's jobs that you need to do. All jobs are just as important. Set aside human notions of what's higher and what's lower. There is no such thing. Right? First will be last, the last shall be first. Right? We know this. We've known this for 2,000 years, if nothing else. Okay, so those really key things that you can think about here. But just, you know, so go again, though, to the ascension career. You're working on that all the way up through the mansion worlds and the Marantia worlds beyond. Making fewer personal plans concerning other personalities. The rebellion was all about making all kinds of personal plans for other personalities. Learning to accept your lot. Because eventually that lot is your absolutely unique puzzle piece in infinity, right? And it's not going to be like anyone else's. So starting in a relative terms, it's moving you towards that. You're not supposed to be like that other person, so stop wanting to be like that other person. You know, you're striving towards being absolutely different from every other person. The extent to which you're the same is the extent where you're not... extent to which you're not personal yet. You're just a self that's trying to break the fetters of material inertia still. Right? That freedom of spirit existence, see, that's what they were talking about up there. Because personality is spirit pattern. Right? And as long as that personality can't engage you holistically because you aren't fully spiritualized, is the extent to which your personality can't manifest. Right? So you're trying to give your personality the opportunity, the liberty to express. Okay, and then this next paragraph is a biggie that everyone knows.
You will learn that you increase your burdens and decrease the likelihood of success by taking yourself too seriously. Nothing can take precedence over the work of your status sphere, this world or the next. Very important is the work of preparation for the next higher sphere, but nothing equals the importance of the work of the world in which you are actually living. But though the work is important, the self is not. When you feel important, you lose energy to the wear and tear of ego dignity, so that there is little energy left to do the work. Self-importance, not work importance, exhausts immature creatures. It is the self element that exhausts, not the effort to achieve. You can do important work if you do not become self-important. You can do several things as easily as one if you leave yourself out. Variety is restful. Monotony is what wears and exhausts. Day after day is alike, just life, all the alternative of death.
Okay. Now, just to notice the way this great big long section ends there. Pretty stark ending. Day after day is alike, just life, or the alternative of death. And, I mean, you know what's between the lines there. Lots of people despair and commit suicide. Right? You know, that's a very simple example of why you would be challenged like this. To engage what your easy drifting soul isn't inclined to engage. If you don't, you won't get what you think you're going to get by avoiding difficulty. Right. You will just begin to implode, and you'll just give up. Right. Obviously, someone on the Mansion Worlds could do that just as well as here. Right. You think, well, it's life on the Mansion World. It's not going to be just life. No, I mean, all of it, Lucifer took his whole life for granted. There's nothing fancy about it to him, right? And so that's a very interesting thing, that they end on such a potent note like that. Okay, but you can see, sure enough, they say it at the beginning of this paragraph. Taking yourself too seriously. Right, in contrast to that, with all cheerful up there. Okay, and then that next statement about there's nothing more important than your work on the world that you're on, whatever world that is in the hierarchy. Right? The moment that you have any spiritual consciousness, your thoughts begin to drift off this world. And you begin to become so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. Right? That's a big challenge. I mean, if someone doesn't have much spiritual consciousness, they don't have any tendency to that. They will dutifully do the work of this sphere without ever thinking about, you know, if there's anything else they could imagine doing. They'll do it well. You know, the spiritually conscious person will think, oh, how prosaic. You know, how lowly, how unimaginative. Well, the cosmos looks at you and say, well, how worthless you are. Right? The problem is not that prosaic person. You know, you're the problem, because you have some spiritual consciousness, and you immediately are thinking, if only we could make the world better, boy, then I could do things. Or if only I could get off of this world and go to the next one where it's fancier, then I could do really cool things. No, there's just as much potential to do good on the lowliest sphere as there is on the Isle of Paradise. Right?
Yeah, practically more.
Right. In the big picture, yeah. Right. There's infinitely more at the lowest level. It's nothing but potential at the lowest level. There's everything to do. Yeah. Yeah, if you have the insight and the foresight and the courage to take up that challenge. All right, so think about how huge a problem that is. How many spiritually conscious people do you know that are, you know, that have gotten caught up in that, you know, dismissing the immediate things. I've got more important things to do than consider my neighbor. You know, what about those people in that other continent that need me to save them, or, you know, whatever notion you have in your head? Yeah, that's what they're getting at. Be really careful about that. It's not a dichotomy. I'm not saying that you throw out, you know, your spiritual idealism. Right? Just recognize that idealism is meant to be applied where you are. Again, of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. What did he do with his spiritual idealism? Was he pining for the future? No, he ministered
as he
passed by. Wherever his feet were, that's where he ministered. Right? He wasn't walking so he could get to that, you know, place on the horizon to minister there. Ministered wherever his feet were. Oh, yeah. So that, thinking like that. And then the bit about taking too seriously. You know, everyone knows this one. The work is important, the self is not. Right? Can you take on that challenge? And there's no greater challenge. The incessant clamoring of inescapable self for recognition and honor. It's not sometimes, it's incessant. It always wants to be first. It always wants recognition and honor. This is one of the reasons why if prayer is thought of as an end in itself, it's so problematic. And why it's caused such destruction. Because prayer is self-reminding. You know, what are they talking about here? They're saying that, you know, if you can, if you could just leave yourself out. They're talking about, they're not talking about self-reminding. What are they talking about? Self-forgetting. Genuine worship, which is communion with deity. Right? So another thing that's going on here is trying to encourage you to follow prayer up. It's a ladder. It's not a destination, it's a ladder. Prayer is a technique to get you up through thanksgiving to worship to a state of self-forgetting, super-thinking, right? Thinking the truth. Prayer is about thinking the facts. Worship is about thinking the truth. There's so many different angles at this issue, just recognizing how universal this is. So no wonder, you know, the angels might be really trying to help you with this. I'm trying to say, okay, now you're probably wondering why that didn't work. Let's sit back and reflect on it a little bit. Notice why it didn't work. It's because you had yourself in play. Right? There's no way I can challenge you or attempt to inspire you to find the truths of the revelation. If the first thought in my head is myself, you know, in my state right now, I'm trying to think of everything but myself, completely self-forgetting. You know, the last thing I want to have in my head is myself, is I'm trying to understand and the truths of the revelation. So challenge yourself like that. And then just that bit about, you know, variety is restful. It doesn't seem that way to an immature self. Right? Immature selves like to have everything exactly the same, every place, every day. Right? Monotony is what wears and exhausts. Don't be surprised if you wind down sooner in your life, if that's the way you try to, quote-unquote, live your life in monotony. You got to have the courage to take on variety. Don't try to get the molecules all arranged just right and then have them never move again. Right? And you're going, well, what could possibly severely negative result from that? Well, what's the bottom line? Just life or the alternative of death, you know? Right? You'll get in that de-animated mode. You'll say, why don't I just give up? You've got to recognize that you have to avoid that tendency that your ease-drifting soul has. It leads you the opposite direction that you desire.
Well, there's a lot of people living on the street, which we think, oh my gosh, they're out there suffering. That's where they feel alive. If they put a roof over their heads and three meals a day, and they quit feeling alive. They have to. It's only. I mean, it's a poor existence, and we can feel sorry for them. But that's where they are. Where they need that feeling, I have to be on the edge in order to feel alive.
Yeah, and so you can see that, you know, some people naturally feel suffocated by any consistency, sort of, you know, and they have to just, you know, live a nomadic existence, right? You know, so they kind of do some of this unwittingly, you know. So if you're not that way, if you're not a nomad at heart, if you have strong tendencies to be very place-like and very static, obviously they're more talking about you here, you know, and you should challenge yourself to mix it up a bit. Take a different route to work, you know, don't take the same route every day, or, you know, don't eat Cheerios every Tuesday, or, you know, whatever it is that you, where you get stuck in a rut. All right, so moving right in.
Don't have too many girlfriends.
All right, then the next section, everyone always delights in this section. It's 28 fold set of bullet points here. All right, let's, before we start, let me just say up front, if you remember from a few papers back, that when they mentioned moda, they gave a definition there of Marancha wisdom for the word moda. Now remember, moda fundamentally is the Latin gerund for motion, when that motion is inherent, not overt, like throwing a baseball, not that kind of motion. But the kind of motion you sort of mean when you say the symphony was moving. Okay, so moda is just the word motion. So remember how they were talking about the, you know, pressure develops stability and certainty. We're talking about that dynamic. You're trying to strike step with the universe of motion. You need a mind that's more and more motion-like, more and more fluid-like, or whatever you want to say. So you have wisdom, and then you have Marancha wisdom. You have a higher, more holistic, more three-dimensional wisdom potential. But if moda kind of means Marancha wisdom, Marancha wisdom, what do they mean by Marancha moda? What do they want you to think there more? What they want you to recognize is another way of thinking about the word moda is it's a word that indicates a higher level of philosophy. It's not just the immediate bottom-up, like human philosophy, without revelation. It's not just the lower hemisphere of a sphere of philosophy. That mode of consciousness allows you to establish a full sphere of philosophy. So another way to think about that title is Marancha philosophy. Yep.
Could you explain real quickly what you mean by philosophy? What exactly? I know, but
just think about it in this way, that your initial thoughts about science, philosophy, and religion as a threefold actuality, if you think about having a transcendent harmonization of those three, you know, you have individuality, associativity, and unity, and you encompass them into some tri-unity, into some holistic harmony. That's an initial way to think of moda, the transcendent harmonization of science, philosophy, and religion. And if you look on the threefold actuality with unity chart, I've got that here in field number 6. You see science in this block, and then philosophy in this block, and then religion in this block. Right? And then if you go down to that field in the bottom block, you see moda. Right? And the parentheticals there, a system of ideas, a system of associations, a system of ideals, and moda having a recognition, you could define it as a system of harmony. Mm-hmm. To be able to treat the triunity, the harmony, in a systematic way is what you're after. So by philosophy, in terms of what it means, think about what it will mean first. Think of it as a word that's going to express the most holistic encompassment of reality possible. Not just a relationship to the unity of it, religion, or the individuality of it, science, but the associativity and the wholeness in ever, ever more holistic ways. The goal of philosophy is universal unity. And in a technical sense, that unity is the tri-unity, just like on the chart, you know, threefold actuality with unity, and by that unity, I mean tri-unity. Right? Okay, so you can see in this first paragraph, they speak exactly to that.
Seven, Maranchamota. The lower planes of Maranchamota join directly with the higher levels of human philosophy. On the first mansion world, it is the practice to teach the less advanced students by the parallel technique. That is, in one column are presented the more simple concepts of Marancha meanings, and in the opposite column, citation is made of analogous statements of mortal philosophy.
Yeah, and the line there is moda meanings.
Moda meanings.
Yeah, there's all these M words. It's got, you have Marancha and mansion and moda and meaning. So it's a, yeah. Okay, so you see on the very first mansion world, despite the fact that you may have all kinds of very fundamental issues in play, they're working on philosophy right away. Right? You don't have science courses, you don't have religion courses, you have philosophy courses. Every course on high is a philosophy course. Right? And it culminates with the masters of philosophy. Right? Wisdom. You know, is about philosophy, you know, just literally the word, right? Loving wisdom, you know, is the word philosophy. Sophia is wisdom in Greek. So they start you out by trying to get you to work up through human philosophy, go up those initial levels of wisdom, and get moving up to higher and higher levels of wisdom. And there's an infinite number of levels of wisdom. There's an infinite number of levels of philosophy. But you can see in that first sentence, see the lower planes of Marancha Moda join directly with the higher levels of human philosophy. See, Moda is philosophy in a more holistic sense. And you say, well, I thought Moda was described the state of my mind. That I have moda consciousness. Yeah. What do I keep talking about that you want to try to develop in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind? A personal living philosophy. Right? A moda-like phenomenon. A personal living philosophy. All right. So they start you out just, you know, kind of spoon feeding you, trying to get you to work up from the bottom.
Not long since, while executing an assignment on the first mansion world of Satania, I had occasion to observe this method of teaching. And though I may not undertake to present the moda content of the lesson, I am permitted to record the 28 statements of human philosophy which this moda Marancha instructor was utilizing as illustrative material designed to assist these new mansion world sojourners in their early efforts to grasp the significance and meaning of moda. These illustrations of human philosophy were...
Okay, now before we read... Okay, so what do you... Very important thing that often kind of gets forgotten, right? We can't even remotely consciousize moda right now. It can't be anything but completely abstract to you right now. So it's not like you have 28... moda points here. No, you've got 28 little bullet points of human philosophy. Okay, and you know, if we're on the first mansion world, they're engaging those people probably in the tongue of Satania. Okay. So it's not like these English points are up there. So what this archangel that wrote this paper, he observed some, you know, human points being brought out. It could be not just from this world, but from many different worlds, being given in the tongue of Satania. But what do we actually have here? What the revelators, you know, what the archangel did is he took what was there and he looked for human writing that we have that basically would express what was there, you know, and those kids had at their desks, you know, if you will, up there in the first mansion world. All right, so, you know, you can look into the human source for this stuff and whatnot. Let's just set that aside. Let's just try to think about the more immediacy of it. You know that the point is not the facts of the book, the words of the book. But do remember, don't get confused if someone brings this up. It's like, well, wait a minute, this, you know, this one and this one are from such and so book or whatever. Well, of course they are, you know. Right? Remember the revelators. If they can find a human that has said something, they have to use those human words. They can't use their own words. That's the way the book is constructed. Okay, and that's fine, because the point is not the words. The point is the truth that you are trying to find that flows through those words. And they've used human words that we have because it should be easier for you to strike step with those words and get going with the dynamic flow of truth through them. It's as evolutional a construct as possible. All right, so you have these 28 statements of human philosophy. So these are statements that should get you moving upward. And then you're looking for trying to bring in the bigger picture of the revelation that you've encompassed, and to try to complete the picture. This is kind of giving you a lower hemisphere. Can you bring in an upper hemisphere and get a full sphere of truth relationship to this? We're not going to attempt to achieve that, but that's the ultimate goal of this section for you as a long-term reflective study, is to try to get moving up with it in a dynamic mode and encompass it and bring it alive in your life. Okay, now there's 28 of them. Let's read them four at a time. If we read them four at a time, how many blocks will we have?
Seven.
Ooh, that's a neat way to do it. All right. You know, is it a coincidence that it's 28, right? Then that's divisible by seven, right? You know, you're going, I wonder if, you know, you could look for whether or not there's a pattern, right? If it breaks into blocks of four.
Maybe that was all on the chart.
Right, but why?
That the teacher was doing.
Yeah, why did the teacher pick 28?
Could have been.
Right, you know that there's some profound reason.
Right,
you know there's a sevenfoldness. You know it's not a coincidence. It's divisible by seven.
But you got to miss a number of them have more than one point in them.
Yes, exactly. Right, and a number of them would be expressed in a much more holistic way up there than here.
Yeah.
Right, again. And again, we're not going to try to figure that out. But I'm just pointing that out. The how much depth you could get into as you try to figure out what the pattern is, what that teacher was trying to do, what kind of a relationship with the pattern of the cosmos they were trying to get going in these students' minds. All right, let's take them four at a time here. Yep.
Okay, one. A display of specialized skill does not signify possession of spiritual capacity. Cleverness is not a substitute for true character. Two, few persons live up to the faith which they really have. Unreasoned fear is a master intellectual fraud practiced upon the evolving mortal soul. Three, inherent capacities cannot be exceeded. A pint can never hold a quart. The spirit concept cannot be mechanically forced into the material memory mold. Four, few mortals ever dare to draw anything like the sum of personality credits established by the combined ministries of nature and grace. The majority of impoverished souls are truly rich, but they refuse to believe it.
Okay, so notice just a little common theme there. Notice how much it's talking about capacity, right? That gift that's being given to you by the mother, right? A capacity for spiritualized mind, specifically. Spiritualized mind. The bit about a pint and a quart, right? A pint of spiritualized mind will not fit into even a quart of just unspiritualized mind. Right? They're trying to get you to think about capacities, just how much potential you have, how much capacity do you have? You have.
You meant that the other way around.
To be objective. No, I meant it that way.
A quart can't fit into a pint. You said a pint can't fit into a quart.
Yeah, I said a pint of spiritualized mind,
right?
Won't even fit in a quart of unspiritualized mind. Right? So I'm playing off of it, right? Trying to get you to appreciate, you know, this is one of the limitations of the hourglass analogy. You think about the hourglass analogy where the upper and lower domains have the same volume in an hourglass, right? But, you know, don't overplay it, just like Jesus told the apostles not to overplay the parables, right? To recognize how vast a potential you have with what's been given to you in that upper domain. Few mortals ever dare to draw anything like the sum of personality credits established by the combined ministries of nature and grace. What you have with the upper domain, the insight potential you have, you know, if you actually used your personality instead of just doing fancy self things in the lower domain and being satisfied with that, if you just took a hold of a mustard seed size, a thimbleful of potential in that upper domain, what you could do, right? That's the basic picture, see, they're painting with these. See, a display of specialized skill does not signify possession of spiritual capacity. Right? Specialized skill is just the lower domain of the hourglass thing. Right? But what about that spiritualized mind? What about the capacity for using spiritualized mind in the upper domain? Cleverness is not a substitute for true character. Okay, your lower domain is clever. Okay, the upper domain has true character. Right? Or, you know, we talk about a self having temperament. A personality has character. Right? You know, the things that are very fundamentally parallel are temperament and character. A self has a temperament, a personality has a character. And that character, you have a tiny little bit by grace to get it started. But in general, character is the consequence of choice. You have to choose to have character. You don't have to choose to have temperament. That's just your boundary conditions. You just have it automatically in its fullness. But you have to, character only comes in any significance as a result of choice. Okay, so the basic things going on here. Few persons live up to the faith which they really have. Right, they may have faith, but they don't have living faith. I see, live up to the faith, right? What's the difference? Well, they're pointing out a basic difference. Unreasoned fear is a master intellectual fraud. If you're just using your faith as an antidote to fear, that's not living faith. That's not living faith, right? You want living faith, where you, which is predicated on fear not. Right? See, Jesus wanted you to have living faith, not mere faith. So he said, step one, fear not. So if there's any fear, that's short-circuiting the life of faith, the livingness of faith, the vitality of faith.
That's a hard one sometimes.
Okay? And again, the lower domain of the hourglass has no faith at all. The only reason you even have non-living faith, just that faith that's trying to antidote fear, is because of what you're given by grace in the upper domain. Right? That basic faith is what you have using the third cosmic intuition with your personality. Right? That initial just grasp. So again, you see, the personality credit. See, not using your personality potential to make faith come alive. A personality can make faith come alive. You were not born with living faith. Right? You were just born with mere faith. You have to choose to have living faith. Okay, so you can see there's a pretty common theme in those first four. How about four more?
Five. Difficulties may challenge mediocrity and defeat the fearful, but they only stimulate the true children of the Most Highs. Six. To enjoy privilege without abuse, to have liberty without license, to possess power and steadfastly refuse to use it for self-aggrandizement. These are the marks of high civilization. Seven, blind and unforeseen accidents do not occur in the cosmos. Neither do the celestial beings assist the lower beings who refuse to act upon his light of truth. Eight, effort does not always produce joy, but there is no happiness without intelligent effort.
Okay, so let's think about these four. So that that mere child of God, that timid soul, difficulties may challenge mediocrity and defeat the fearful. They only stimulate the true children of the Most Highs. Right? Instead of being a negative actuality, it becomes a positive potentiality. And notice the limitation on these students. They're limiting them to the constellation level for God. The children of the Most Highs. Okay, starting them out small. Remember Jesus did the same thing, even though he was doing a new dispensation, because he was doing it out of order. He kept it in the Adamic mode, where God is basically the Most Highs. So you can see they're giving it to him at that level. Challenging him to go from child to an adult. To enjoy privilege without abuse, to have liberty without license. Again, bringing in this, more adult-like character. Where the work is important, the self is not. So everything isn't so immediately, ooh, wow, I could really play that to my self-benefit. Right? Remember in the previous thing, remember how they talked about the wear and tear of ego dignity, the expression they used back there. What's another expression we have for that self-aware self, the ego dignity? Self-esteem, right? Which is not a positive word, right? No matter what culture is telling you, right? Self-esteem is a negative word, right? Self-respect is the highest positive thing. If you take it above that, it becomes all good things taken to extreme become bad, right? If you go above self-respect to self-esteem, it's becoming negative. Take it even further to self-admiration. Now it's really getting negative. You'll be like the child of self-love, like Lucifer. Okay, so that whole bit about, to have liberty without license, right? And, Satan was calling him the God of Liberty, right? You see how that's all swirling around in that. That bit about self-aggrandizement, taking it above self-respect, to self-esteem or worse, false elevation of self, and the pride that goes before a fall, that is self-esteem. And then throwing in these are the marks of a high civilization, right? Again, because remember, civilization is in its genuine nature, is a personality phenomenon. It's chosen. There's nothing automatic about civilization. Culture, is natural. But not civilization. That's the distinction. Civilization has to be chosen. Culture is just what happens naturally. Okay? So to have a civilization is to choose to be more than what you are naturally. To identify with that which is above you. And hence, lift the civilization up above the natural. Quote, unquote, natural. So again, you can see this bit about personality and maturing. Blind and unforeseen accidents do not occur in the cosmos. Neither do the celestial beings assist the lower being who refuses to act upon his light of truth. Okay, so let's think about that one for a second. One of the things you might think about is how in supremacy there are no coincidences, right? So that whole bit about blind and unforeseen accidents do not occur in the cosmos. It also makes you think about even as mortals, so have these angels been father to many disappointments. Right? Okay.
Makes me think about the time Jesus fell down the stairs and I said they couldn't do anything about it. And it wasn't their fault. Was that a blind?
Not in supremacy. Right, not in supremacy. In the immediacy, it was. It was just one of those things. It was just.
That makes me think of the death of his father by accident, which obviously had a meaning to
right,
it.
Right. It's so interesting. Right, but even the smallest thing has meaning in supremacy of the whole. Right, it has to be fairly big before we can think. Well, I think maybe there is some meaning there. Like you can see some meaning to Joseph's death. Right. Okay, but that bit about, neither do the celestial beings assist the lower being who refuses to act upon his light of truth. Okay? There's no light of truth in the lower domain of the hourglass. You only relate to truth in the upper domain as a person. So think about the consequences of that statement, how huge that is. Right? If you're not taking delight in cultivating, really activating your personality, using your personality. Don't be surprised if you don't get all kinds of magical, seemingly magical, providential help in your life. Right? They only help that which is real. Their job isn't to produce more delightful arrangements of molecules. Okay.
For instance.
Right. I wanted to stress one thing. Okay. Notice that it does say refuses. Yes. Right? The being who refuses to act. Right? So there has to be some willful rejection here. Okay. Yeah. It takes personality to take delight in cultivating. Right? That's not something that's natural. That has to be chosen, right? So, if you aren't choosing, you're refusing to choose. Right? There definitely is a bit of an edge to this. You need to really take delight in cultivating. They're gonna foster your connectivity to the cosmos. Right? And if you don't have that connectivity as just an animal origin self. All right. Did I get the other things? Yeah. So just that last one then. Effort does not always produce joy, but there is no happiness without intelligent effort. Does that make any sense to you? Does that seem like a meaningless statement?
Experienced it.
How do you understand it? I mean, are joy and happiness synonyms?
No.
No, they can't be. If they are, this sentence is nonsensical.
There's no happiness without intelligence.
Effort does not always produce joy. But there's no happiness without intelligent effort. Right, what is it trying to tell you there? It's trying to get you to reflect on the difference between joy and happiness. Mm-hmm. Right, and the transcendence of happiness over joy.
Exactly.
Right? Joy is just a spiritual experience. That's just the feeling, the pleasurable feeling you have as a spiritual experience. It just happens. Right? It's a response to a stimulus. nothing profound about it really at all. But there is no happiness without intelligent effort. Happiness only results from choice. Right? Happiness is much more sublime and transcendent, a pleasurable feeling than joy, if you're using the word happiness properly. Right? Happiness is very, it's not just, happy is not a fancy animal thing like joy.
Would the Beatles say it was?
Happiness is a very, very profound word, and the Revelators are trying to get you to understand that. And your greatest happiness is when the external stimulus would produce the opposite of joy, would produce sorrow. If the external stimulus would produce sorrow naturally, but if you choose instead to respond to that apparently negative stimulus in a positive way, the feeling you'll have in your mind is transcendent of joy. That's what the word happiness is supposed to mean. It's why it's appropriate to have the Beatitudes say, happy are they. Right? Because they're not talking about fancy animal stuff. They're talking about something only a human can do. No animal can be happy. Not even a fancy animal can be happy.
Or joyful.
Yeah, just having the sixth adjutant doesn't give you, can't produce happiness. It'll produce joy. Fancy animals can be joyful. Remember, that's on the level of the feelings, that sixth adjutant. Religion is everyone pursuing feelings of joy. No, that's just spiritual experience. That's not personal spiritual experience. That's not religion. That's being spiritual, not religious. You have to exercise your personality, right? So that there's nothing natural about what happens. And matter of fact, it's the opposite of what would happen naturally. Then it's happiness. Right? So when the Declaration says that you have the right to pursue happiness, right? If you think happiness is like when a dog wags its tail, right, then you don't understand the Declaration. You have the right to choose to have a positive feeling in your mind in the face of negative stimuli. That's what you have the right to. And that's what those angels were doing to you. Right? They were producing an environment that naturally would produce a negative feeling inside. And they're getting you to use your personality to choose to have a positive response despite the negative stimulus. And until you start choosing that positive response in the face of that negative stimulus, they'll just keep piling on the negative stimuli.
Aren't they saying another part that we don't know happiness very well at all?
Right, remember how they say that? That's because of what I'm just saying. Right, humans know basically nothing of happiness. Because humans don't know anything about personality, the exercise of personality. They just know about temperament and selves. And some selves naturally are joyful. The universe says, who cares? Okay, I can build a robot that experiences joy. Okay? But only a person can experience happiness. And that's what you're supposed to be trying to do. Okay? See, and happiness, there is no happiness without intelligent effort. Right? You have to choose. You have to make an effort to have a positive form in your mind despite the negative stimulus.
Yeah. And that's what our beloved angels are doing. Stimulating us.
Giving you opportunities to pursue happiness.
It doesn't just come from negative stimulus, does it? Happiness?
Mm. Yeah.
Positive stimulus can't bring happiness?
Again, that's just joy.
But isn't... Isn't there a happiness in being joyful?
There, happiness is a joy-like feeling, but more. It's the joy plus. It's sort of super additive joy. You know, I mean, there's just you know, obviously if you choose to have a positive form in your mind, that will produce that feeling that you normally call joy. But it isn't, that positive form is not just, didn't just happen naturally as a response to a stimulus. You've chosen it. So it's a super additive consequence. So it's a more sublime thing. It's super joy. Happiness is technically super joy. It's joy-like, but it's more than just joy, because it only results from choosing. Right? In the face of an, you know, that's what, you know, that's what all they were talking about back there in that last section. Right? You know, so think about that. You know, most people think that the Declaration says that you have the right to be joyful. You have a right to an environment that has no negativity. You know, it's full of safe spaces and pleasantries. That isn't what the Declaration says. No. No, you have a right to pursue happiness, a positive inner life in the face of a negative environment. That's your right. Right? You aren't shackled where you don't have that liberty to choose happiness in the face of difficulty. Right? That's what the United States is about, is liberating you from such bondage as you don't even have the opportunity to choose to have a positive response to a negative stimulus.
Just is.
You know, you're just completely beaten down and subject to the negativity. You have no ability to objectively stand above it. You're wholly subject to the environment. If the environment is pleasant, you're quote-unquote happy. No, you're not quote-unquote happy. Right? You're just joyful.
Joyful and nappy.
And if it's negative, you know, you're sorrowful. Right? And you're this roller coaster. How many people live a life of roller coaster? You know, where the environment changes from positive to negative, and they vacillate from between joy and sorrow.
Isn't everybody's life a roller coaster?
Emergency.
Not someone named...
Maybe a roller coaster, but that's, it all depends on how you deal with it.
Not someone named Jesus.
That's what he's talking about.
What did Jesus have? Jesus had a peace that passed all understanding. Right? What was so not understandable about his peace? He's being subjected to incredible negative stimuli, and yet he's peaceful. This passes all understanding. Not to someone with objective mind, it doesn't.
Right.
You can choose to respond positively. And that's what Jesus did. He was cheerful, they said.
Right? Very annoying.
Right?
Disquieting.
Right. That's what it means to be a human. See, you know, to recognize that that's what it means to exercise your personality, to do what's not natural. Think about how we get fixated on doing what's natural.
Yeah.
Unwittingly, you're moving your consciousness away from personal. The more you seek what's natural. To be personal is to be artificial. It's an art form to be personal. You are artistically taking a hold of the clay of life and doing something with it that is good. That's what a person does. Okay, let's do four more.
Okay, 9. Action achieves strength. Moderation eventuates in charm. 10. Righteousness strikes the harmony chords of truth, and the melody vibrates throughout the cosmos, even to the recognition of the infinite. 11. The weak indulge in resolutions, but the strong act. Life is but a day's work. Do it well. The act is ours, the consequence is God's. 12. The greatest affliction of the cosmos is never to have been afflicted. Mortals only learn wisdom by experiencing tribulation.
Okay, so you see, kind of in the same mode, but bringing in action here, right? One must do something as well as be something. Right, and that doingness, that's related to the Supreme. And here you have it. The act is ours, the consequences is God's. Right, and up there in the Supreme papers, you know, that's where they explain that. You know, that that there's this, you know, as they say, that All men do thus form a part of the divine experiencing of the Supreme. The act is ours, the consequence is God's. Right? The God's there is God the Supreme. Right? What are they talking about? They're talking about the formation of the Almighty part of the Supreme, the upwelling part. Right? All of your acts as a person acts. Right? Your genuine personal action, personal acts, are reflected up through the Supreme Creator personalities into the summation, the upwelling part of the Supreme, the Almighty. Right? It's literally God the Supreme's. Right? That reflection of your action. Religionists may not always act wisely. They may even act religiously, but they act. Yeah. Right? That spiritual but not religious? Well, that's a dead, not living. Right? Passive, not active. action achieves strength. You know, that's the foundation. One must do something in order to be strong, to build up that spiritual strength. But then you bring moderation into that. Right? When you weave in a little moderation to that action, that eventuates in charm. Now, why do they use the word charm instead of just delight? Because they want it. It's almost a magical-like delight, right? Is what the sense of the word charm is. When they see that you're strong and you're acting, and you slip in some moderation, everyone goes, "Oh, that's cool! It's like magical, delightful." The way they did that. Oh, the artistry of that, right? It's an art form, right? Using, that's artificial. The universe is mind-made and personality-managed. The whole point is to make the universe artificial, not natural. An art form of personality. Righteousness strikes the harmony chords of truth, right? Righteousness is conformity with the cosmos. So you consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. So you can see the harmony there. The wholeness of truth is there. And the melody vibrates throughout the cosmos. Conformity with the cosmos.
Yeah. That thing I was telling you.
Yep.
From that movie, right? Like movie Gladiator, where he says, "What we do in time echoes in eternity."
Yeah, right. Okay, so those ideas. But the strong act. They're stressing that life is a day's work. Do it well. Work is important. The self is not.
Number 11 reminds me of the fellowship's executive. Make more resolutions, but don't ever do anything.
Yeah.
It was recently New Year's Eve, right?
Yeah.
The weak indulge in resolutions.
But they're talking about it.
But the strong act. And then this whole bit about happiness, right? The greatest affliction of the cosmos is never to have been afflicted. Because you're devoid of happiness then. If you've never been afflicted, you have zero happiness. Right? Now, just because you're afflicted doesn't mean you have happiness. You have to choose to respond positively to that affliction. Right? Mortals only learn wisdom by experiencing tribulation. Here's an example where humans know that tribulation can lead to wisdom, but humans don't know this.
I'll say.
That you can only learn wisdom through tribulation.
You know, I can't imagine how people argue with me about this affliction, never been afflicted, you know. Oh, no, that can't be true. I mean, it's like, that goes against
conventional wisdom. No, conventional ignorance. Right. So this whole bit about Marancha Moda, right, Marancha wisdom, higher levels of wisdom, higher levels of philosophy, right, the only way to learn wisdom is by experiencing tribulation. Right, so if you're trying to seek a life that avoids tribulation, your life will be devoid of wisdom. And the only way to get from a seventh circler to a sixth circler, for instance, is to acquire some wisdom. So guess what? You're going to die as a seventh circler. Right? You're not going to get anywhere with the psychic circles. Okay? All right, let's read four more. No. He was just making a comment.
13. Stars are best discerned from the lonely isolation of experiential depths, not from the illuminated and ecstatic mountaintops. 14. Whet the appetites of your associates for truth. Give advice only when it is asked for. 15. Affectation is the ridiculous effort of the ignorant to appear wise, the attempt of the barren soul to appear rich. 16. You cannot perceive spiritual truth until you feelingly experience it, and many truths are not really felt except in adversity.
Okay, we don't need to expand on all of this, but just, you know, notice things like, you know, the ecstatic mountaintops. The apostles wanted to build tents and stay up on the mountaintop forever. No. You need the contrast, you know, like the inevitabilities, right? The contrast. See, whet the appetites of your associates for truth. Give advice only when it's asked for. I mean, the give advice only when it's asked for, you know, everyone resonates with that, but think of it in the context. Why does that have something to do with whet the appetites of your associates for truth?
Okay. So they experience.
You can't give someone truth.
They have to arrive at it.
They have to discover it experientially themselves in the upper domain. Right? The only way to get there into that upper domain is to ask questions. Right? You want a person to struggle to the point where they ask a question. Okay, now there's a potential. Okay.
An art to hold a question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a good question is worth a lot more than a ton of answers. Because a good question will keep on giving.
Yeah. Because it's related to truth, see, like they're saying, not just fact. Mm-hmm. Right? That's how you get them in relationship to truth. They have to ask a question. And of course, fundamentally, we need real questions, not just religious questions, but philosophic questions. The kind of questions that your seventh adjutant will initiate in your mind. The philosophic impulse. Okay? You know, affectation. You know, just think about that for a second. I mean, You know a lot of people, when they get some spiritual consciousness and they have a desire to be impactful, they take on affectations, right? They wear certain clothing. They speak in certain ways. Right? The next time you see someone who claims to be oh so significant, a religious figure that you should engage, now, look at all the affectation they have. They're always dripping with affectation. Affectation is the ridiculous effort of the ignorant to appear wise. Should you listen on the edge of your seat to their wisdom? No, their affectation proves they have no wisdom. They're ignorant, and they're trying to cover it up. Don't fall for that trick. That's the oldest trick in the book. The first thing that the so-called spiritual leaders in the tribes, the shamans, did was take on affectations. It's the oldest trick in the book. Don't fall for it. It's a sign of ignorance, not wisdom. The attempt of the barren soul to appear rich. Pretty strong language. Okay, and you cannot perceive spiritual truth until you feelingly experience it. And many truths are not really felt except in adversity. There's the adversity thing again, right, to get you into relationship to truth. But one cannot perceive spiritual truth until you feelingly experience it. What are they getting at there, right? There's the initial bit of knowing the truth, because you feel it, you feelingly experience it. But then you can go beyond that. When you can actually perceive it, you can think it. Yeah. Right? You got to go beyond feeling it in order to think it. Right? That's what they're getting at there. You cannot perceive spiritual truth until. So they're moving you up, knowing the truth, obeying the truth, thinking the truth, moving you up the levels. Okay.
Therefore, I think.
Yeah. Take four more here.
17. Ambition is dangerous until it is fully socialized. You have not truly acquired any virtue until your acts make you worthy of it. 18. Impatience is a spirit poison. Anger is like a stone hurled into a hornet's nest. 19. Anxiety must be abandoned. The disappointments hardest to bear are those which never come. 20. Only a poet can discern poetry in the commonplace prose of routine existence.
Let's start with that last one, the delightful challenge of that. So you think you're a poet. Are you regretting the past and whining over the present because of its lack of potential, like almost every spiritually conscious person on the planet is doing? No, you're not a poet. A poet is a person that can see the positive potential. Right. Think about, that's the whole challenge of a poet, you know, and just, you know, the act of writing a poem, is to take the crude limitations of language and see potentials in it that others don't by juxtaposing things in ways that others wouldn't imagine doing. Right? See what they're getting at there while they're using the poet analogy? Right? You want to be able to start going beyond the surface of its negative actuality and see the infinite positive potentiality of things. Okay, now you've struck step with the poetry of life instead of the prose of life. You've struck step with the truth of life, not merely the facts of life. Of course, anxiety must be abandoned. You know, that's pretty straightforward. You know, what kind of a corroding influence that's going to be in your mind. Impatience is spirit poison, right? How did Adam and Eve get to where they went? Started with impatience. How did Lucifer get to where he went? Started with impatience.
My hour has not come.
Step one is always impatience. Okay, and someone who doesn't have spiritual consciousness is naturally patient. Someone who has spiritual consciousness is naturally impatient. Because spiritual consciousness has no consciousness of time. Matter of fact, it quickly begins to hate time. It wants eternity, right? And wants everything now. What do we want? Blah. When do we want it? Now.
Yesterday.
Right? Every chant of the spirit of a spiritually conscious person speaks to their impatience. Right? And that's poison. The moment that you make that sign and chant, when do we want it now? You've poisoned your spiritual mind. Right? You think you're doing something, you know, lofty. No, you're poisoning your relationship to the cosmos.
How did we get there?
You're doing the exact opposite of what you think you're doing. Right? You're making yourself utterly worthless.
But this is not a dichotomy either. There's a.
But just
as you grow, you get better.
Right.
At this, I guess.
Right. But you know, you notice how they're stressing. You know, these are beginning students, right, that are getting these lessons, right? Step one is to stop the delusional thinking, you know, to recognize that the things you think are positive are negative. You know, immature children always have things flipped around, okay? So you see that as part of this lesson here. Let's see, did we get everything else there? Let's see. The bit about ambition, right? You need to socialize that. You have not truly acquired any virtue until your acts make you worthy of it. Just one little thing to note there about the difference between value and worth. Remember that? Value is a spirit word. And when you bring it down into relationship to the individuality, that's when you use the word worth. So think about that when they say that. See, your acts make you worthy of it, right? You know, and you actually engage the individuality, act upon it. You bring the unity down into relationship with individuality. You know? So there's worth. So getting at there. All right, let's get some more.
21. The high mission of any art is, by its illusions, to foreshadow a higher universe reality, to crystallize the emotions of time into the thought of eternity. 22. The evolving soul is not made divine by what it does, but by what it strives to do. 23. Death added nothing to the intellectual possession or to the spiritual endowment, but it did add to the experiential status the consciousness of survival. 24. The destiny of eternity is determined moment by moment by the achievements of the day-by-day living. The acts of today are the destiny of tomorrow.
So put 22 and 24 together in just a quick little reflection there. So the evolving soul is not made divine by what it does, by what it strives to do. The destiny of eternity is determined moment by moment by the achievements of the day-by-day living, etc. Okay. What's the definition of goodness here? It's not perfectness. Right? In an evolutionary domain, it's perfectingness. Right? That's what that means, that perfectingness. The evolving soul, see, the evolutionary domain, is not made divine by what it does, right? You're trying to achieve perfectness, but by what it strives to do. Right? You're trying to be perfecting, not perfect. And that's what they're getting at with those, getting you to think about, thinking about what it means to be an experiential creature rather than your initial spiritual consciousness gets you off in delusions of existentialness. Okay? Yep.
You know, in our immaturity, when we think of perfect, we automatically think of it's a static picture we have in our mind. We can't help it.
Yep.
We take the dynamic character out of it. Perfection is fixed in stone. I mean,
right. Because you're thinking so existentially. For those of you in the webinar, if you can hear that, you're saying, you know, perfect is so, seems so fixed in stone to us. He's saying, yes, because see, you're thinking existentially, right? You've got this relationship to the Father, relationship to existential deity with your initial spiritual consciousness, and it biases you to the existential, to stasis, right? But you're not an existential being. You're an experiential being. You're an evolutionary being. The bit about italicizing survival in 23 there, the literalness of the word. Sur is short for super, above, and vival, living, right? It literally means living above. Right? So that, they're italicizing you. They want you to think about the etymology of the word, the literalness of it. I'm living above where I used to. Wow, that changes everything. That proves that there's a verticalness to the cosmos. Right? I didn't reincarnate on the plane and go around the circle one more time in the plane or something. I'm not just living again. I'm living above. Whoa, there's a whole other dimension to reality that I never appreciated. There's a vertical dimension. That's what they're getting at there. Let's see. And then 21 there, the high mission of any art is by its illusions to foreshadow a higher universe reality. Right? True art should motivate you toward the Marantia. If you're an artist here, that's what you're striving to do. And they're giving you a little way to think about that. To crystallize the emotions of time into the thought of eternity. Think about, most people think that the point of art is to just fixate you in the emotions of time. Just get you, into the emotions of time and just, pool into it, right? No, not liquid that you're going to pool into. To crystallize those emotions. It's, the emotions prime the pump, but then the point is to crystallize those emotions, get them solid, take them up into the thought of eternity. It's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. Right? Feelings go upward, thoughts go upward, feelings go horizontal. Right? So what is the thought of eternity? Thinking the truth, the truths of eternity. Okay, let's do the last four.
25. Greatness lies not so much in possessing strength as in making a wise and divine use of such strength. 26. Knowledge is possessed only by sharing. It is safeguarded by wisdom and socialized by love. 27. Progress demands development of individuality. Mediocrity seeks perpetuation in standardization. 28. The argumentative defense of any proposition is inversely proportional to the truth contained.
Okay, a lot of people remember that last one. Okay, that we've spoken of 25 here several times recently. The great man is not he who takes a city or overthrows a nation, but rather he who subdues his own tongue, right? Right. Not so much possessing strength, it is making a wise and divine use of such strength. You know, that's one subdues the tongue, the wisdom, the personal living philosophies that, you know, that requires. And again, on 26, knowledge, the literalness of the word is what they're wanting to reflect on. But the ledge part, remember, means giving. Knowingness that can be given is knowledge. Knowledge is possessed only by sharing. Yeah, see, they're just repeating the literalness of the word, knowingness that can be given, right? It's safeguarded by wisdom. It's only, you know, if you're going to actually get knowledge to someone, it has to pass through a wise mind. Otherwise, it'll get twisted and before it's put out to them. Right? So it's safeguarded by wisdom. And socialized by love. Right? I mean, why would you, ultimately, why would you want to socialize anything? Right? That foundation of love. Progress demands development of individuality. There's lots of very spiritually minded people that love the word progress, like to make an ism out of it, progressivism. But think about that. Those people often see individuality as maybe even evil, at least some sort of a hindrance or something, right? Because you're fixated on unity. You want to melt away all the individuality. Now, demands development of individuality, right? The universe wants to progress. So step one on the local system level, fundamentally individuate everyone, like we've been talking about. Get that Marantia individuality fully established, because then you can be a means for progress.
Stepping apart from the union of a congregation, in many cases, is considered evil. Yeah. Step apart from it.
Right. Yeah. See, and again, that whole bit about your personality is absolutely unique. So if your immature spiritual consciousness is biased against individuality, it's biased against personality. See, again, how it's like, oh, well, I didn't want that. Well, that's what you get, right? you've got to recognize that individuality is not evil. Right? God made you an individual, and I believe God is good.
The church would burn many people who would try that in past ages.
Mediocrity seeks perpetuation of standardization. You know, just think about all those tendencies to want to make things conventions. And again, it's like the ridiculous effort of the ignorant, right? I mean, it's actually your mediocrity is on display rather than your enlightenment. You know, the argumentative defense of any proposition is inversely proportional to the truth contained. I mean, that's predicated on, okay, the actual context of truth. Not so-called truth or something, but if you literally, genuinely involve truth, just think about it logically. The whole point of truth is that it's self-evident, right? If you actually take hold of truth, I don't have to explain anything to you and encourage you along that line. Truth takes you along a line, right? That's what they're getting at. It's one way to know if you have a hold of truth rather than just a rationalization scheme of fact. If it just naturally carries you forward, right? But if you have to be reasoned forward by someone, they're not bringing you into relationship to truth, right? You know, you know, me sitting here talking and talking and talking and talking. You know, no amount of my talking can give you the truth. And, you know, don't think that, well, maybe if I go back and listen to him some more, my life will start to go somewhere. No, it won't. It doesn't matter how much I talk, right? You need to get a hold of truth yourself, and then everything will take care of itself. I won't need to try to somehow think of some clever analogy to get you to go, oh, maybe he's got a point there, right? If you actually get a hold of it, I won't have to say anything. It'll be self-evident to you. All right. And then their little footnote here.
Such is the wake of the beginners on the first mansion world, while the more advanced pupils of the later worlds are mastering the higher levels of cosmic insight and Marancha Moda.
All right. So, like I was saying, it's philosophy from the bottom all the way to the top and beyond. And, you know, and we can't even remotely imagine what an advanced pupil is trying to learn, trying to encompass. Mastering the higher levels of cosmic insight and Marancha Moda. So that Marancha philosophy. And, you know, no matter how much wisdom, philosophy you've encompassed, it's always being sparked by something that's transcendent of that, an insight. Right? Eventually, the insight you have right now will be at eye level, and it'll be sight. Then there'll be more transcendent insight in play. On and on and on and on, until finally, what's at eye level is to a high degree the completeness of the finite. And then your insight will begin to be absonity. You'll begin to actually have an insight that transcends the finite. You won't have a sight of the absonite, but you'll have an insight into absonity when you get up to the higher levels. You know, the finaliters, you know, are moving around kind of at the ceiling levels of the finite. Right? They're working in that highest mother womb of the collective super universes. Right? They've gone above super universe, you know, individuality. Right? So they can begin to have insight that transcends the finite. Okay. So just, you know, that's how it gets started. You know, you develop that personal living philosophy by taking delight in cultivating a relationship to the three cosmic intuitions. Your current insight, your current transcendental insight, that current sparking begins to supply the favorable conditions to have something that you can see. And the more you can see, the higher your insight above that. You know, you stand on the shoulders of giants ever upward.
So it seems to me, you know, like when you read the Revelation or read your answer book, you know, you do get a lot more insight in what goes on, what's going on. If we were sitting here trying to discuss this without the Revelation, it'd be...
Right.
So, discuss what?
Yeah, right, discuss what, exactly. Right, that's the point.
So, I guess my thing is that as you go into the schools of the mansion worlds, you know, you're going to get even more and more of this type of information or teachings or whatever,
That
are going to help you be able to see it better, and then you have to live it.
Yeah, and remember, that's one, the other thing about Moda. Right now, since we don't have Moda, can't have Moda, the only way that we can have that bigger context to reflect on this stuff we're reading, this human philosophy, is because we have the Revelation. But the more you have Moda, the less you need Revelation. Right? Moda is a substitute for Revelation, just like Revelation is now a substitute for Moda. Right, it goes both ways. So, the more they, you know, you actually develop a mode of consciousness, the more you have naturally the big picture in which you can assimilate the details. That's the point of mode. All right. So then they just have a final section to kind of put a cherry on top here. Give us a little bit of a poetic ending to this. But I want to stress what John was just saying there, because it's very important. Recognize that the more that you can encompass the whole revelation, the more you can get out of these 28 points of human philosophy. So you want to keep coming back to them, you know, and see if they're more living, you know, the next time, and then the next time, and then the next time. It'll be it's a way that you can tell that you're progressing in your relationship to the whole of the revelation. The more you can encompass the whole, the more you'll have the context for these statements to come alive. So it's one of the reasons why they gave it to you. They want you to work on bringing those two hemispheres together, the wholeness of the revelation, the upper hemisphere, and then the individuality of the human philosophy, like these 28 points, the lower hemisphere, to bring them together and make it more and more holistic, more and more living all the time.
And it's easy to remember because they're on paper, page 555.
Yes. Yeah, you can always get to the beginning of it. 555, yes.
Oh, thank you, Dad.
Yeah, and notice how appropriate it was, the supremacy, that we coincidentally had to still read, you know, about the ministering reserves before we read this. Notice how much I was working off of what we had there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, so what is this last section here?
8, the Maharaja Progressors. From the time of graduation from the mansion worlds to the attainment of spirit status in the super universe career, ascending mortals are denominated Maharaja Progressors. Your passage through this wonderful borderland life, will be an unforgettable experience, a charming memory. It is the evolutionary portal to spirit life and the eventual attainment of creature perfection by which ascenders achieve the goal of time, the finding of God on paradise.
Wow. Again, just notice how they wanted to use charming again rather than delightful, because they wanted to, you know, even though there isn't literally magic, you know, it's like almost indescribably delightful. You know, it's that magically delightful, yeah. You know, the connotation of that word.
Cartoon figure sort of lights up and sparkles.
Borderland life.
Right, so your whole, you know, local universe career is a borderland life.
Interesting.
Right? Kind of like being stuck between plant and animal. Right? Like they talk about that as borderland life. Right, just, you know, to remind you of, you know, even the first world of the borderland life is beyond your imagination. How much beyond your imagination is first stage spirit? Right. Right. It's the difference between a human and a sponge. Right. So.
You're being kind.
You just you know, open yourself up to a vast question mark future. That's what a Maharaja Progressor is. Someone who's delighting in the mystery of what lies ahead.
There is a definite and divine purpose in all this Maharaja and subsequent spirit scheme of mortal progression, this elaborate universe training school for ascending creatures. It is the design of the creators to afford the creatures of time a graduated opportunity to master the details of the operation and administration of the grand universe, and this long course of training is best carried forward by having the surviving mortal climb up gradually and by actual participation in every step of the ascent.
Okay, so just one little, yeah, I mean, this is all pretty straightforward, but think about in the context of what we were just reflecting on, that your challenge to that in that paragraph. Have you mastered your spiritual consciousness enough that you can be patient enough to realityize that paragraph? Right? I mean, that whole bit about the opportunity to master the details. Oh, I don't care about details. Let's just go for the zeal. To master the details of the operation and administration, of the grand universe. And this long course of training is best carried forward by having the surviving mortal climb up gradually, right? And by actual participation in every step of the ascent, not skipping any step, being patient. Again, the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it, right? The religious life of Jesus was not the religious life of Paul. The religious life of Jesus was a gradually. The religious life of Paul was a suddenly. Mm-hmm. Right? Not a very helpful example. That
that's
Paul.
Right.
Right? You know, that whole conversion thing that's been so aggrandized because, you know, Christianity is Paul in many ways. Right? No, it's not Jesus. Jesus was a gradually. Right? That will help you to let go of trying to live that Pauline religious life. Try to, you know, follow the gradually of Jesus. Okay? The faith of Jesus, the first section of the last, Jesus the man, the first section of that last paper, the faith of Jesus, is preceded by a mind-bogglingly long preface, right? To get to Jesus the man, you have to go through this incredibly long preface. It's like, why isn't this section one? Why is this the preface? Because it's trying to teach you that the faith of Jesus was achieved as a gradually, not a suddenly.
No magic.
Right? It's not like Paul. Okay? And that's very difficult because we've all been, you know, just indoctrinated into that, you know, seeking a conversion experience sort of a thing.
Pollinated,
yes.
I have a saying, all right. It goes inch by inch, life's a cinch, yard by yard, you'll find it hard.
Okay, so just that, see, why did I belabor that very straightforward paragraph? What were we just saying? If you want to find the living nature of a paragraph, you have to bring in the whole revelation, right? Modeling that for you, right? You don't have to literally give words to it like I have to do here for 5 minutes, say, right? But in your mind, pause and bring in the fullness of the revelation. Oh, that's relating to that and that. Yeah. Put it together. See it in a holistic fashion like that. All right?
The mortal survival plan has a practical and serviceable objective. You are not the recipients of all this divine labor and painstaking training, only that you may survive just to enjoy endless bliss and eternal ease. There is a goal of transcendent service concealed beyond the horizon of the present universe age. If the gods designed merely to take you on one long and eternal joy excursion, they certainly would not so largely turn the whole universe into one vast and intricate practical training school. Requisition a substantial part of the celestial creation as teachers and instructors, and then spend ages upon ages piloting you one by one through this gigantic universe school of experiential training. The furtherance of the scheme of mortal progression seems to be one of the chief businesses of the present organized universe, and the majority of innumerable orders of created intelligences are either directly or indirectly engaged in advancing some phase of this progressive perfection plan.
Again, all pretty straightforward, but just notice they were doing what I was doing a little bit ago. You know, every spiritually conscious person has a bias that they were just challenging again there about what destiny is. Even if you don't think of it in doctrinal terms, you know, like a Buddhist might, right? But it's there to some degree where you think that the whole point is endless bliss and eternal ease. Right? That's what your initial spiritual consciousness will believe. That whole bit about if the gods designed merely to take you on one long and eternal joy excursion.
Disneyland.
Right? Joy excursion.
Yeah.
Right? See, if it was all just about you and your spiritual experiences, one long and eternal joy excursion. No. And it's not about joy. It's about something greater. It's about happiness, right, which has to be chosen. Right? Joy is wonderful, but it's just a beginning. It's an initial statement of your potential, that you can experience joy as a fancy animal. But don't build a tabernacle and dwell there forever, like religionists have always wanted to do, where joy is an end in itself. Right? Joy is not the purpose. The purpose of a religious life is not joy. In a bigger sense, the purpose of a religious life is to spark a philosophic life. And a philosophic life can experience happiness. A religious life can only experience joy. All right, and then the final statement here.
In traversing the ascending scale of living existence from mortal man to the deity embrace, you actually live the very life of every possible phase and stage of perfected creature existence within the limits of the present universe age. From mortal man to paradise finaliter embraces all that now can be, encompasses everything presently possible to the living orders of intelligent, perfected, finite creature beings. If the future destiny of the paradise finaliters is service in new universes now in the making, it is assured that in this new and future creation, there will be no created orders of experiential beings whose lives will be wholly different from those which mortal finaliters have lived on some world as a part of their ascending training, as one of the stages of their age-long progress from animal to angel, and from angel to spirit, and from spirit to God. Presented by an archangel of Nebadon.
All right, just a couple little points. I mean, maybe that take that last little technical point. I mean, no one, I hope, is confused about that. You're obviously never going to be an angel. Okay, so when they say from animal to angel, they don't mean you're going to become an angel, right? But just you're at eye level with animals, and then you're at eye level with angels, and then you're at eye level with full on spirit type beings when you're first stage spirit and beyond, and then eventually you're at eye level with God, right? He's standing on the Isle of Paradise. Okay. So there's that. And then the thing about when they're talking about creatures in the Absonite Age, in the next age, okay, did you understand that? That, they're saying, well, okay, if there's going to be experiential creatures, we know one thing. None of them are going to overlap with any of us. Finite creatures and our experiences, right? Because the whole point is you ascend to perfection and then you penetrate to completeness. And like they were just stressing there, we're talking completeness, period, right? There's nothing of a finite nature left to do. It's all done. So anyone after that, any creature after that, right, can't have anything to do with any of that. It's all been done. It's just like what your initial spiritual consciousness would like your life to be is that of a Havona native. But no, before time began, all of that was done. Right? The number of Havona natives is beyond our numerical concept. Right? And every single existential beingness sort of existence is done. Right? There's nothing left for you to do like that. You live in the experiential evolutionary domain outside of the central universe. Right? And you have to face that. That bias that you initially have to wanting to live in Havona, to be a Havona native, one must do something as well as be something. Right? Because those Havona natives have the being this thing covered. There's not a single blank spot left. It's all done. Right? You're other. Yep.
So is that saying that when the entire super universes are settled in light and life, mm-hmm. and the supreme is manifest,
yep.
that there won't be human beings being born on planets anymore, and then experience the, that finite life will be done, so to speak?
Yeah, there'll be absolutely nothing left of the finite. There won't even be finite distances or finite angles.
So there won't be people.
There will be countless creatures eventuated for endless absentite ages, but no finite creatures will be created anymore, because that will all be done. It will be complete. That's, you know, they're trying to get you to really,
that's big.
Not just complete, yeah. but no, complete, period, complete. Wow. Nothing finite left. Yeah, like I said, I mean, even geometrically, when everything transcends the finite, I mean, you literally don't have finite distances between objects anymore. You don't have finite angles anymore. You're in an absentite geometry.
Yeah.
Right? the whole finite geometry.
Does it disappear, or is it just?
You just transcend it. Everything will be separated in absentite space, not finite space.
But do the Avona Naves transcend Avona?
When the grand universe is settled in light and life, everything will change in Havona too. Okay. Just like when the super universe level started, everything changed in Havona. Mm-hmm. It'll change again.
The grand universe shrinks down to the nucleus, such as the Havona and...
Right. A simple way to think about it is the central universe just expands out to encompass the seven super universes, and you have a greater central universe for the first outer space level. Yeah. And then you'll have a greater central universe for the second outer space level, mm-hmm. et cetera. Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, so next time we'll start a whole new block of papers. That's it for the local system level. Now we've got a set of papers on the inhabited worlds. So we'll switch gears a little bit and bring it all closer to home.
We'll all be patient.
As we've been coming down... Right, from the local universe headquarters level here through part two. Finally, rubber's going to meet the road. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.